Start with a reading today. This is from the Anguttara Numerical Discourses, Book of the Tens, Second Discourse. And at time to time I will be selective, but move through the main points. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted, let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted, let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. One who is joyful, no volition need be exerted, let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted, let my body be tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted, let me feel pleasure. It is natural the one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted, let my mind be concentrated. It is natural the mind of one feeling pleasure is concentrated. For one who is concentrated, no volition need be exerted, let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural the one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. For one who knows and sees things as they really are, no volition need be exerted. Let me be disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural the one who knows and sees things as they really are is disenchanted and dispassionate. For one who is disenchanted and dispassionate, no volition need be exerted. Let me realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is natural, the one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. Thus, bhikkhus, one stage flows into the next stage. One stage fills up the next stage for going from the near shore to the far shore. And just to add to this, because many of these suttas are more or less repeat themselves, people are obviously very keen to gather everything they possibly could of the Buddha, what the Buddha said. And clearly he must have had a particular template he was teaching, and sometimes he would add certain touches to it. And this one adds the touch. Suppose there is a tree deficient in branches and foliage. Then its shoots do not grow to fullness. Also its bark, softwood and hardwood do not grow to fullness. So too, for an immoral person, one deficient in virtuous behavior, non-regret lacks its proximate cause. When there is no non-regret, the sequence goes on, there is no knowledge and vision of liberation. So I add that because well, a certain striking features to this are so much the hallmark of the Buddha's presentation. One, it is, as he said, one who teaches should bear in mind the teaching should be from this step to that step, and this step to that step. It has a purpose, it's one feature of it. The aim is liberation, and it's always a step by step by step. That is, it's no just one shot, this is it. There's no sense of just do this, it's going to work. No, it's always do this in sequence. So this will ripen to something else. And there's that beautiful sense in which this obviously very deeply experienced being knew from his own mind and from the minds of others that this would work. There's something natural that if the heart is filled, it will overflow into the next stage. Put it that way. You know? And this word natural, of course, is dhammata. So you've got a bit of a play. The English language can't always capture all these things. Dhammata, in accordance with truth, with nature, and of course the play is in accordance with Dhamma. Dhamma is nature, natural, but perhaps in a way that reminds us how much all of our minds are not natural. They're contrived. They're contrived by social pressures and mixed messages and media and fantasy and assumption and bias and just down plain right ignorance. You know, we're not really in touch with the natural flow. And this is not just blaming, it's something to do with the way our, you know, culture's got structured in terms of consumer, profit, money, power, which are cancerous. They do not lead to harmony, they do not lead to overall welfare, they're not whole. They're very partial. They lead to advantage of some, disadvantage for most. This is not in accordance with the understanding of what nature is in this Buddhist sense. It doesn't mean trees and flowers. It means the natural Dhamma, the natural order of the cosmos where things are held in balance. That's what nature means. So this very word itself, you know, people think nature is kind of like Grand Canyon or Black Forest or something. No, it's the natural order where things are in harmony. And the role of the human being is to act as the ethical axis of that. As it said, when kings and ministers act rightfully, people act rightfully, people live in harmony, the devas are pleased, the seasons come on time, the crops grow, people are well fed and nourished. When kings and ministers act foolishly, people act foolishly, devas are not pleased, the weather fails, season, climate change, destruction. And this was said 2,500 years ago, and what do you think about that? So this sense of the ethical axis which a human being is capable of, and nature is both microcosm and macrocosm, so we can see something where we can get a very kind of cosmic view, but also the cosmos can be just the intimate cosmos of one's own embodied experience. And this is particularly where this teaching is pointing. If one is in harmony in that fundamental ethical sense, then the opening and the fruition of the heart into joy and happiness is natural, if you stay with it, if you don't lose it, of course, if you don't lose the focus. If you don't lose the focus, if you stay with it, mindful, bearing it in mind, staying with it. And if their heart is happy and contented, there's transference into the body. Again, you know, in our unnatural world, we don't even realize the body is an intelligent system. It's just the kind of thing you dress and use as a mode of presenting yourself. This is who I am, I look like this. You know, like... emphasizes separation and distinction, doesn't it? I'm big, I'm tall, I'm white, I'm black, I'm brown, I'm female, I'm this, that, or the other. Discrimination. No. That can only set things apart, can't it? Obviously, there are differences. The main thing is, what unites us, if we feel happy and contented in ourselves, and that's brought around in a skillful way, not through sense contact, but through innate heart virtue, happiness is felt as an embodied experience. Internally, it's what I refer to as the internal body. So when the Buddha talks about practicing mindfully externally and internally in the body, my reading and practice of that is external means that which touches from the outside, physical contact, internal, that which is moving internally, one's sense of tension or shock or gladness or ease or balance or... And this is the area of breathing, isn't it? So anapanasati, breathing, where the energies of the breath flow through the internal body and there's happiness. So this all lines up. And that quality is the proximate cause for concentration, samadhi. And that quality, we call it samadhi, collectedness, concentration, stabilized heart, because these are heart effects. You can see things clearly because you're not rocking around, you're not twisted or contorted, you're not compressed and pushed, you're not straining. You see things clearly, it's like this. And the mists of delusion and the fantasies and the phobias begin to evaporate. My goodness. You know, what is song and dance about? You know, it's crazy stuff that human beings get involved with. Like, what is all this? And you become dispassionate towards it, and so forth. You see, liberation. So liberation then is, you know, it's not just a kind of vague esoteric notion. You're liberated from greed, hatred, delusion. You see things as they clearly are. So rather than hankering for something or fighting with something, resisting and complaining and feeling embittered, things are like this. And the heart stands free in its own domain. Not through excluding itself, but by not picking things up. Not picking up the wrong messages, not picking up the wrong signals. So that's why it's natural, because in a way you could say it's always there, but we're not always natural. We're not really always in harmony with the cosmos. We are kind of caught up with this or that, or focusing on this particular detail, or pressurized in some way. We're not even clear and steady and comfortable. We're pushing, resisting, fighting, you know. Pressuring ourselves, pressurizing others, pushing. It's so normal. You know, stress is now considered normal. You know? You get, you know, it's just like, see things for dealing with stress. This is what you do, have a drink of water or something like that, deal with the stress, which is natural, obvious result of being alive. It's now normalized, I think. And loneliness, which is a result. You know, we have a minister for loneliness in Britain. Probably nobody goes to see her. Why lonely? Because everybody's in their own fractured state and there isn't that harmony. You just look at the loss of veracity in the spoken domain. When you can't rely upon what anybody says anymore as being true, or truth as being actually an important feature of life, what's going to happen to relationship? Individually and in terms of society, you know, cynicism, bitterness, loneliness, depression, so forth. And it's building up through basically a lack of sila, virtue. You know, and just seeing this kind of sequence in the Buddha, saying this is the path that begins somewhere, it's kind of obvious in a way, to a degree. But it leads to things that perhaps are not so apparent, like what's concentration then? And I guess, like many of us, begin meditating the idea that we should try and concentrate our minds. And so we focus on a particular thing. It could be a mantra, could be breathing, could be a particular object we focus on to get concentrated. And then it's generally pretty much a struggle to hold it together, and then something happens, a window opens, a door slams, somebody drops something, and I lose my concentration. And I get angry and upset. And I don't want to be with this crowd of noisy people, go and sit somewhere on my own, and then, dang it, ant bites me, and then can't get comfortable, and then, you know, and the weather's too hot, too cold, and then something, you know, they're always getting fighting against the conditions and feeling irritated and disappointed by it all, and then feeling I just can't do this, I don't have enough willpower, enough push or something to get it, you know. But wait a minute, we backtrack and you realize actually if you really look through the teaching, the Buddha never told us to concentrate on anything. He never said concentrate on anything in that sense. Be one-pointed, but when you see one-pointed, it refers to the heart. It means, you know, have a certain sense of aim and purpose that you really feel true about and good about and authentic with. You put your heart into it, and it's going to pull things together. Some things, no. Then restraint becomes kind of pretty natural. No, I'm not interested. No, that's just going to take me out. And you begin to realize there's a definite distinction between the world of citta, which is to do with aims, intentions, ethical qualities, fear, mistrust, very potent qualities, joy, depression. They're internal. And it's distinct from mental, or manas, which is to do with concepts, ideas. In other words, things that have no particular feeling to them. And by and large, our education is one in terms of concepts and notions, symbols, abstracts, square root of minus one, which is an unethical problem. Yeah. And these become things that are extremely crucial for one's welfare in the world. So we train that focus, and that focus definitely does concentrating. And it's concentrating on symbols, concepts, objects that you can discern with a thinking, rational mind. And certainly this feature of our experience is an important one. But it can get to the point where, you know, you get so obsessed with their details of their work or their job or their colour of their wallpaper, they lose their temper or get angry or get stressed or get obnoxious, obsessive. They've missed the main point. We haven't discriminated what's happening in the heart. In other words, it's outgoing. And this sense of the outgoing sense consciousness, which includes mind is problematic and has to be mediated through proper heart qualities. So since we do function in the sense world, let that functioning be led not by sensory data, but by how we relate and manage and stay tuned in to what's happening in our own hearts. This you should definitely concentrate on. Or perhaps more kindly, one should be one-pointed and know that and begin to, as you know that, feel how do you trust it, because it makes you feel good. It's not a feeling that's egotistical, it's just a natural feeling that arises. A heart feeling that suddenly wells up. You feel relief, you feel joy, you feel grateful. Hey, where did that come from? And naturally that definitely energy gathers into that. So this process of concentrated is the energies of the heart are collected together and become firm. Yeah. But notice this begins not with focusing on a point externally or not focusing on a point externally. So you could have your awareness of the whole room visually. And actually that might be more useful, because keeping that sense field quite open, not getting focused on narrow points, the details become less significant. And instead, you know, this is a pretty calm room. It's pretty steady in here, pretty still. Yeah, this is nice. If we lose the sense detail, suddenly we reveal the heart experience. Yeah. So often actually microscopic attention on sensory details blocks or obscures awareness of the heart. So you can see in a room like this, you can think, you know, keeping a visual focus on all that. Oh yeah, it's just overall, the overall sign is still. Still, humans, peaceful, safe. That's the heart impression. Attentive, alert. That's pretty nice. Now you could go into, I don't like his blanket. Or what's she wearing that funny hairdo for? Or, you know, you get into these things, and then you'd lose it, wouldn't you? You could say, yes, I've got a good concentrated mind, but you lost the heart, and then you get into this should be that, and she should be this, and he's not that, and he's bigger than her, or whatever. You know, you get into this discrimination, and the whole thing breaks up into disharmony. If you're not doing anything, you still don't feel comfortable. So in coming to the wholeness, you come out of discrimination on the sense fields, but then you come into harmony in the heart field. So when the image is used of the branches and leaves, see, actually that image of a tree, branches and leaves, it means that something is definitely reaching out. Branches, leaves, they're open. They're reaching out into the environment. And that's what makes the heart, the bark and the heartwood strong. Not because the leaves and branches are curled back, but they're extended. But they're not obviously they're not leaving the trunk, right? So, but when we're asked to bear sensory strength in mind, what do you think's reaching out? What do you think's opening out? Is the heart is opening out into the shared domain. Okay? And this connected to one's own embodiment strengthens it. Strengthens it. If you feel the safety, if you're the friendship, if you're the gladness of companionship, if you're the harmony, and it strengthens and it strengthens and it strengthens, it takes away the fear, the guilt, the regret, whatever. We're strengthened by a field of goodness. And yet you can live in places like this and miss it, because she doesn't sit this, he doesn't sit that, he's late, she wears that funny thing, what are these people doing here? You can just completely miss the whole thing. Yeah, it's too that, or the truck drove past, it's too noisy. Come on, you know? You know, that's that movement, the asava, the leakage into sense fields, karmasava. This isn't always just seeking fun or bananas, it's just that tendency to keep going out there into that and either infatuating with it, fantasizing with it, or finding fault with it. And just, you know. So the reaching. And so this really reminds us of the fullness of what Sila is about. Now again, if you try to emphasize, you know, Sila is not just about laws and rules. Virtue is not just about obedience and conformity. It's about having a sense, ethical training and sensitivity, valuing others and valuing one's own purity. Recognizing if I don't do that, it gets a bit twisted in there, it gets darkened. I haven't looked after that, I've probably made some messes. If I haven't valued others, I've probably in some way or another abused them or looked down upon them or done stupid things with them. If I haven't valued my own heart, I've probably let myself down in a bit stupid and reckless, and haven't we all? But then the right view says, okay, well, that's good that you see that, because that which sees it is the foundation of right view, and you should be thankful indeed that right view has arisen. That sign then even of remorse, skillful, is actually a healthy sign. You know the perils, you know the dangers, and now remind yourself, what actually are you looking after? Something that's very sensitive and is affected and needs to be given the proper food and care. And this is what Sila is about. Mm-hmm. So it's not just do this, don't do that. I mean, that's a very abbreviated code. One can use 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, and so forth. But actually, Sila Dhamma is relational intelligence, relational sensitivity to nature. Yeah. So it means the trees, it means humans, it means one's own heart is unbroken. And it's just not just what we don't do. When you really enrich yourself with this, you realize, oh, this brings up certain, when I enter that, something I feel I must do. I must express gratitude, otherwise it's not virtuous. I haven't really fulfilled the proper relational integrity. I must express appreciation, or at least in my own heart, whether I speak it or not, otherwise I haven't fulfilled it. I must also celebrate it in others, Because this isn't just like, I'm such a good boy. This is the quality of sila when I see it around me. It's touching, beautiful, uplifting, inspiring. It reminds me, it gladdens me. Other people's virtue strengthens me. I feel confirmed and lose the cynicism. So then you open out into that. It's a field. It's field view rather than entity view. This to me is what the Sammā refers to, like the Sammā Sambuddhassa is fully, completely, Sammā view, right view, fully complete view. It gets the whole picture, sees the whole picture, cause and effect, good and bad, how things line up, the whole deal. Yeah. And if you're just focusing on the sorrows and mistakes, yeah, that's part of it, but that's not whole view. Whole view says also there's the rightful, the clear, the ethically sensitive, get the whole picture. And then you are enriched by that, both in terms of one-pointedness, you know there's something to be protected and cared for here. You know the dangers, you know the escape, you know something to be focused on. There's your focus. And you're focusing right on what's most important, which is the movements of the heart, movements of the citta. And clearing the signs of regret, signs of inadequacy, associated personal contact, I'm not very good at this, I've made mistakes, I can't do this, I'm a bit fumbly around that. Okay, well that's just stuff, isn't it? But can one cultivate harmlessness, veracity of speech and conduct? So we're not just saying something, we're saying it and doing it. And saying it and doing it and acknowledging it in others and celebrating it in others. This is the fulfillment of it. Not just whether I'm getting it right, but when I notice around me there are those who inspire me, I celebrate that internally. Then I'm fulfilling the field of sila. Yeah. Opening to all of it. And that sense of discrimination fades out. Not who's better, just there is the beautiful. And when, so gladness, pamoja. So it's certainly things one refrains from doing, things one deliberately cultivates. And then you follow it up. Have I taken the time to express gratitude, to look after others, to pick up the signs of when somebody needs some help? Or I just ignore them. So this, it begins to turn this idea of meditation into something much more natural and unbroken. So a lot of my lifestyle is really based upon sila, not just in morality, but in terms of I feel it is important and I help others. Otherwise I don't feel I'm really, fulfilling the blessings and privileges that I've been awarded or arisen for me if I don't somehow share it as best I can. So this then acts as the basis for our community harmony. And the community harmony based around certain core themes. One is dana, one offers, one shares, shares requisites, shares time, shares company, shares advice, shares the burden, shares the weight, is someone who is grateful to be asked, you know, can I help? Piyawaja, one is, above all, speech, our means of fundamental, most obvious relationship. Speech is piya, affectionate, warm, friendly, not just accurate, but actually tonally gentle, heartwarming, good-natured. Knowing not just the information, but the tonality of voice and word goes straight to the heart. Do we cultivate that? Attacharya, purposeful conduct, doing things that are fulfilling the atta. Not the atta, but the atta. Atta is self, atta is purpose, aim, means. What is our aim? What is our means? Purification. Liberation. Very important to get a sense of that and how that lines up with the piyawaja. If we're just getting into doing things in order to get things done, accumulating all kinds of to-do lists, then does the dana disappear into just got to get things, got to do something? We're all volunteers. Does the piyawaja get a bit sharp? Where is this piya? Do we miss the point? You know, do all kinds of stuff, but actually not aimed at purification and liberation. Yeah. And then certainly monasteries, the reminder is, look, place is not about fantastic resort, it's not spiffiest, greatest, most advanced, functional, everything works on time. No. It's not. We do the best, for the main thing it's about purity of heart. And for that we say, okay, things break down, things don't work, things aren't, yeah, but you know. Doing what you can. Because it's not a purpose, isn't to have fantastic everything, but to have pure heart. Samanatata, even. So this is to do with evenness in terms of everybody, we see people equally, whether the guest or the abbot or the senior nun or the person who's just bringing today's dana, we see them equally, equal respect, equal value. Because everybody, whatever their bodies look like, everybody has heart, everybody has citta, everybody has that potency, and we can awaken the potency for awakening and virtue in others by our sense of giving them proper regard. Proper regard. Not seen as them, but seen as you. And so, and just that honouring is quiet. How glad one feels in one's heart to be able to honour people to their struggles and their life stories and their pains and their aspirations. No one's not worthy of regard. When you establish that, the whole view means you begin to see yourself in that light. Not as someone who needs to be corrected, improved, fixed, tidied, bits amputated, shaped up, chopped. Someone to be seen with regard. Even this. Been through this, been through that. a living being. How can joy not arise? How can there not be gladness? Samana the Dulsa means we cultivate, you know, really, you know, get too edgy about. I mean, I do a lot of sitting meditations. I'm not going to deny it. It's a main pillar of my life, I guess. But I really try to keep, as best I can, a sense of every spoonful of food requires equal attention. It's not just one thing after the next. You know, every cup needs equal attention when it's washed up. It's not something to get out of the way so I can get to the next thing. Every footstep when I walk to the Dhamma hall is equally important. It's not just blur from the kuti to the door of the Dhamma hall. Every footstep, it counts. Because it does. In the real world, in the natural world, in the mind, it doesn't. In the mind aims for the number on the clock, the symbol, the concept, the fear of getting it wrong, the fear of being late. Where's the gladness? That's how it goes. We've swapped our natural world for a world of ideas, symbols, concepts, and our practice is to walk back from that, to get back on our feet again. So even, you know, cleaning out the bins with equal attention, as if one is firming up one's cushion, clearing your throat for the chanting, holding your body upright, and it's every moment is new and fresh, every moment equal attention. How could there not be joy, vigour in that? No matter what, whether your voice is no good, whatever that means, just coming back into that, what is the most important thing? We cultivate this because it, you know, it has to be cultivated. It's not just to get back to really into the flow of nature. When you've cultivated like this, you're going to find your body begins to become more natural, less broken up into blocks and lumps. And you get the breath flow as a living force that's constantly shifting rather than a fixed object, something that infuses the body with its vitality and warmth. How could you not be glad for that? If it's gladdened, embodied, one-pointed, collected, how could there not be samadhi? So in this way, from, you know, that's how it goes, step at a time. This, if you start on the right track, sustain the right track, you end up in the right direction. If you start on the wrong track, it's just the struggle. So the Buddha teaches this for our ease, welfare, comfort and confidence. So let's take the time to practice in accordance with these themes.